The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Okay. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Yeah.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
What do you think?
Just
I
like
love
that.
It. That was great. Thank
there you go. Welcome to a Wednesday, everybody.
Laughing. Big laugh out in the hall.
Not, you know, none of that hard stuff, none of that soft stuff. Just a lot of talk, actually, here on the program. Welcome to a Wednesday. I'm choking on the words because I don't quite know where to go with this. I'll explain in a moment. Let me first tell you, I'm excited about our guest today. Our guest is, you know, I'm not much of a sports person. My husband has made his living in the sports world for 30 some odd years. He was an agent for professional baseball players. But sports is not a thing with me. But there's one guy who's a sports journalist who I really like, who I've had the opportunity to interview a number of times over the years, and I always enjoy talking with him. And that's Dave Zirin, because his niche is kind of the intersection of sports and politics. He's the sports editor at The Nation magazine, right? Who knew The Nation had a sports editor? Well, because of the work Dave Zirin does. He has a podcast, Edge of Sports. That's his Twitter handle as well. And he's written something like 10 books. Yes?
Why did you cut 10 years off?
40 years. Sorry, I was trying to, 40 plus. I was trying to, you know, make you seem a little younger rather than the anti-dilute, what is it? Never mind. Rather than the old fart you are. But anyway, Dave Zirin has written 10 books. I don't know if this is his 10th or if his 11th, but it's called The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. And, you know, it's a topic I'm interested in. I think what Colin Kaepernick did is extraordinary. But this is not a book about Colin Kaepernick. It's about the effect he has had, or his taking a knee had and still has, on younger athletes and other athletes everywhere. So we'll save that. He'll be with us at the bottom of the hour. I encourage you to stick around because I always have a great time talking with Dave Zirin. And today's topic, I think you will find interesting. But today, there are a couple of things that have me a little bit riled up, you know. And I guess I've been a bit verbose on Twitter today, which is interesting because when I woke this morning and I went on Twitter, and I saw that I was one follower shy of 20,000. Yes, I had 19,999 followers on Twitter this morning. And so I posted something like, who's going to be my 20,000th? And then I went about my business, in which I tend to offend people because it's what I do. So now... I'm afraid to look. Now I'm down to, let's see, where am I now? Oh, I'm back up at 19,997. I was as low as 993, so I was 7 shy of 20,000, just because I guess I was pissing some people off. But I guess those kind of tweets in which I tell John Podesta to fuck off get some people on my side. So why did I tell John Podesta to fuck off? Good question. Well, now it's down to 995 again. It's so weird. It just fluctuates up and down. And Twitter doesn't tell you when someone unfollows you. So you just have to kind of guess. But anyway, why did I tell John Podesta to fuck off? Because CBS News just tweeted, John Podesta warns Democrats they won't get the, quote, full $3.5 trillion investment and urges them to, quote, unite in moving forward. So let me reiterate, and I'll reiterate with a song dedicated to John Podesta.
Fuck you,
Okay, so what's going on here is, and if you listen to the mainstream corporate media's framing of what's happening, progressives are trying to tank Biden's agenda. Well, you know what? Both parts of this infrastructure package are Biden's agenda. The part that's already passed the Senate, the one, and I hate couching it in terms of the cost of the package. So let's use the equally bad names that the people who wrote the bills gave them and the media calls them. So it's the BIF. The BIF is the first part, is the hard infrastructure bill, the one that already passed the Senate and is ready to go. It passed the House in a different version. Then the Senate made some changes, so it has to go back to the House, and they have to pass it in the same form that the Senate passed it. Then it can go to Joe Biden. But think back. Remember, as they were planning this bill, they set it up as a two-parter. There was the BIF, which stood for Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework. But it's stuck. So that's what it's called, even though it's not a framework anymore. It's a fully fleshed out bill, but it's still the BIF, right? The other one is the reconciliation package. That's also infrastructure, but kind of the human infrastructure part that includes healthcare, climate change, education, you name it, the things that didn't fit into the other one, right? And it is a larger package. It's $3.5 trillion over 10 years. So figure $350 billion a year, which is a hell of a lot less than we spend on many other things. And this will actually make life better for millions and millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. So you think what was 20,000? Oh, Jeffrey Kale says, I think I was number 20,000, Nicole. You're not, because I still don't have 20,000 followers on Twitter. You might have been for a fraction of a second, and then someone unfollowed me or blocked me. So, story of my life. Love me, know me, love me, hate me, block me. Okay, so let me share with you one of the best explainers that I found of what's going on. And it's from Greg Sargent, who writes daily. He writes a column, actually more than daily. He writes numerous times throughout the day at the Washington Post. It's called the Plumline Blog. But, you know, it's labeled as opinion. But what Greg Sargent writes is not, they're not opinion pieces. They are fact-based. But it's sort of like what I do. You know, I hope what I'm saying is based in fact. Yes, I give my opinion, but I'm always based in fact. And as you know, hopefully from experience, if I get something wrong, I want you to correct me, because the last thing I want to do is give out fake news. That's not what we do here. Anyway, so Greg Sargent, he wrote this yesterday. On the Plumline blog at the Washington Post. And the headline reads, Biden's agenda is in trouble. It's absolutely clear who is to blame. And it's not a long piece, but there's so much information in here that will dispel some of the bullshit that you're hearing from those corporate media jerks and the trolls on, online. So here's what Greg Sargent wrote. As Democrats hurdle into the final stretch of negotiations over the multi-trillion-dollar reconciliation bill. Oh, I need to qualify one other thing. Sorry. He constantly uses the words centrist and moderates. Okay. I don't believe there are centrists or moderates. And if we're talking about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Josh Gottheimer or whatever his name is, let me, you know, the name of the moderates. They're not moderate. Susan Delbene, Josh Gottheimer, Stephen Horsford, Stephanie Murphy, Mike Thompson. Those are these conservadems in the House who are now threatening to blow up the deal that they already negotiated. They had a deal set up. So let me go back and read Greg Sargent, because he explains what the deal was. And it still is. And the progressives are trying to stick to the deal. And the conservadems are saying, deal? What stink? We don't need no stinking deal. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. Okay, so Greg Sargent writes, as Democrats hurtle into the final stretch of negotiations over the multi-trillion dollar reconciliation bill, centrists holding out against its spending levels are spinning a new narrative about how we got here. Don't let them get away with the rewrite. If President Biden's agenda does implode, which seems at least possible, the centrists themselves will be the ones to blame. This should also prompt a reconsideration of the mythology that centrists, unlike progressives, are distinguished by their steely, clear-eyed determination to make Washington, quote, work, and their refusal to let hard governing realities get obscured by gauzy ideological nebula clouds. The latest standoff concerns the process by which House Democrats will pass the $1 trillion bipartisan hard infrastructure bill that passed the Senate and the $3.5 trillion human infrastructure reconciliation bill. Politico reports on the latest threat from centrist House Democrats. Quote, a group of 5 to 10 House moderates have signaled to leadership that they would be willing to let the infrastructure bill fail rather than be held hostage by liberals over the broader spending bill. It's a more attractive alternative to them than having to vote for painful tax increases to pay for an unrestrained social safety net expansion, according to a person familiar with the discussions. Senator Kyrsten Sinema has made similar threats. Meanwhile, Senator Joe Manchin wants a reconciliation pause. This is likely posturing. Centrists want to reduce the spending and taxes in the reconciliation package and want Democrats to pass the infrastructure bill on September 27th, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has agreed to try to do. But progressives are vowing to vote down that bill until the Senate completes a reconciliation bill. So such centrist threats seem designed to increase leverage. The centrist story here is that they piously want to get something done, but they're being held hostage by progressives in thrall to the in-the-clouds ideological fantasy so radical that voting for this would be worse politically for them than imploding Biden's entire agenda. A review is in order. This situation largely flows from the fact that centrists, such as Manchin and Sinema, insisted on pursuing a bipartisan infrastructure bill in the Senate. Progressives opposed this, believing correctly that it would squander valuable time, and because Democrats could always pass everything by reconciliation alone. But progressives essentially accepted this outcome. Remember, back in March, progressives reached a general understanding with the White House. They would swallow the need for moderates to try for Republican support on infrastructure with the understanding that progressive priorities would pass by reconciliation later. So progressives made accommodations at the outset. The two-track strategy arose to ensure that the two sides would exert leverage on one another, holding the party together. But a small band of he says centrists, I say conservatives, threatened to oppose a procedural vote to start the reconciliation process, forcing Democratic leaders to rupture the two tracks with a planned September 27th infrastructure vote. There was never any serious rationale for that. But regardless, it is in response to that move that progressives are threatening to vote no. In doing so, progressives are just trying to maintain the original two-track strategy, which is rooted in a hard-headed appraisal of both factions' needs. By no means have progressives been blameless, writes Greg Sargent. They're often too quick to accuse moderates of being squishy sellouts. Well, you know, when the shoe fits, but no, sorry, I digress. And it's still unclear whether progressives will accept reductions in the reconciliation bill needed to help to keep centrists on board. But on balance, progressives have been the true realists here. As Jamel Bowie writes, centrists enjoy the image of being grown-ups. because they tend to come from swing districts and supposedly have a, quote, sense of the possible. But as Bowie notes, progressives have already reduced their reconciliation demands, and they have a more realistic assessment of the politics. What's at stake is the success of the Biden agenda. The party will rise and fall with that together. The progressive position is realistic on substance, too. As David Dayan notes, the centrist tendency to start with a generalized aim of lower spending levels for their own sake creates artificial constraints on our investments in our country and people, regardless of the value of their returns. What's more, it'll be disastrous if the U.S. goes into this fall's global climate conference without passing a very robust climate agenda via reconciliation, potentially hamstringing U.S. global leadership and our long-term ability to do what scientists say is needed to curb global warming. Aren't those who want to avoid that scenario the true realists? Here's more realism. If progressives do vote against the infrastructure bill, the world won't end. It's not that uncommon for bills to fail the first time and then pass later. Indeed, Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky, the House Budget Committee chair, says Democratic leaders might pull the infrastructure bill if progressives appear close to ensuring its initial failure until the Senate is close to finishing the reconciliation bill. Yarmuth told Greg Sargent, quote, I think it probably what would happen is we wouldn't vote on it. Leadership would pull it. Nancy would go to the moderates and say, we don't have the votes. You want it to go down or you want it to live to fight another day. And that would be okay. It would be a step toward the eventual goal of getting Biden's whole agenda right. In this scenario, both sides would get their way. This time, progressives are the ones focused on a hard-headed inside game assessment of how to make Washington work, one built around the sort of ideal of compromise that centrists constantly claim to represent. Greg Sargent, you hit the nail right on the head. Right on the head. Because that's what this is all about. As he calls them, centrists or moderates, these are the conservadems who are so afraid that, oh, you know, we need to lower taxes and are not concerned enough with about taking care of their constituents that people like John Podesta are willing to tank the entirety of Joe Biden's agenda. This isn't the progressives' agenda. This is President Biden's agenda. So, I've gotten into it with a few people on Twitter today, which is why I probably lost a few followers. But that's okay, because it's not about the follower count. It's not about the number. It's about the quality. You know. There's something else that happened today. So there's this deal that, God. But there's another deal that was allegedly in the works that is now no longer in the works. The headline reads, Republicans and Democrats unable to reach deal on bill to overhaul policing tactics in the aftermath of protests over the killing of Black Americans. Yeah, just the what they sent in the email alert. I'm not even going into the article because we know what this is about. The Washington Post wrote, a bipartisan group of lawmakers has failed to achieve a long-discussed overhaul of police practices meant to stem the killings of Black citizens at the hands of law enforcement officers, an aide to one of the members said Wednesday. Senators Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, and Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, along with Representative Karen Bass of California, had been negotiating for months. They were unable to resolve the issue of whether to loosen or eliminate the doctrine of qualified immunity. That's the sticking point. Qualified immunity shields police officers and police departments from any civil liability in cases of misconduct. So a cop could maim you, assault you, kill you, and you have no recourse. You cannot hold them civilly responsible. And we already know that the court system rarely holds these killer cops criminally responsible. So this is basically a free, you know, get out of jail free card for cops to continue doing the shit they've been doing for decades or longer, for centuries, let's put it that way. And that, you know, that would make me, that would be a red line for me too. There would be no bill, no compromise if the Republicans insisted on keeping qualified immunity, and they did. So here we are. Here we are. And the one thing they're still not talking about, the filibuster. The filibuster would fix it all. But you got Kyrsten Sinema, you got Joe Manchin, who are by no means, by any stretch of the imagination, centrists or moderate. They are not moderate. Moderate is middle of the road. Moderate is someone who would, you know, bring down the temperature a little bit, right? A centrist is someone in the middle. We don't have centrists in this country anymore. We have right wing and left wing. Seriously, I think the right wing is a hell of a lot more dangerous than the left. But really, this is where we are. We are at an impasse. And then there's the whole debt ceiling fight. You know about the debt limit, right? While, you know, the former guy was in office, the Democrats went along with them. And what they did was, rather than each time the orange idiot increased the debt, which he did by almost $9 trillion in four short years, way bigger spending than Joe Biden or Barack Obama or anyone else. He ran up the tab. But they didn't have to raise the debt ceiling because they suspended it and the Democrats went along with them. Because the Democrats are the adults in the room. Look, as much contempt as I have for many of them, and I do, and the party as a whole, at least, you know, they were trying to do the right thing here. But as we've learned, especially with Mitch McConnell as Senate Minority Leader, no good deed goes unpunished. Because Mitch McConnell is going, we're not going to help you raise the debt ceiling. Now, know this. The debt ceiling, or debt limit, however you want to call it, is the amount of money that the country, that the U.S. government can legally borrow to pay our bills. This is only dealing with past debt, not current debt, not future debt. This is the money that Donald Trump added to the national debt, that they will not increase the debt limit to ensure that we can pay the bills that they approved. You know why I talk about opposite world all the time. This is Donald Trump's debt. This is his $2 trillion boondoggle giveaway to the wealthiest in this nation, to the millionaires and billionaires that didn't help you or I one iota. This is what that's about. And Mitch McConnell's saying, we're not going to help you do this. In fact, they're whipping against, the Republicans are whipping their members to vote against voting to increase the debt ceiling. What happens if they don't? If they don't increase the debt ceiling, we default on our loans, on our payments, which puts into peril the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. That has never happened before. So we're in a really perilous situation, and it's the doing of the Republicans under Mitch McConnell and, to a lesser extent, Kevin McCarthy in the House. And I say to a lesser extent because he's just an idiot who his only goal is to become Speaker of the House, much like, you know, Trump's only goal was to stay in power or to get more power. The idiots like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Josh Gottheimer and Stephanie Murphy and the rest of them who just won't go along with the party that they purport to be members of. If you don't want to be Democrats, then leave. If you're going to act like Republicans, you know what? Join them. Actually, wait until after the next election, please, because if they join them, they'd have control of both chambers, and that would mean Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader again, and Kevin McCarthy as the Speaker, which, you know, God forbid. So I guess in this instance, we do need them, but it shouldn't be that way. And I'm not, you know why we're in this position, and I'm not going to go blaming Barack Obama, but you know where I'm coming from. we were left in a bad position. The party infrastructure, since we love that word so much, suffered deeply under the last Democratic president. He didn't leave us with a deep bench at all. He left us with no bench. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but now is not the time to give in. So the progressives, you know, while the media is trying to, there was a CNN Chiron, something, you know, about the progressives tanking the Biden agenda again. No, that's not it. That's not it. So it's just frustrating. Can you tell I'm a little frustrated right now? Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you what else I need to tell you about before I move on. Oh, this is a good one. So Ryan Grimm of The Intercept just tweeted, for people wondering why progressives are not okay with the bipartisan infrastructure bill without the reconciliation bill, let Congressman DeFazio explain it colorfully for you. And so he retweeted something from Sahil Kapoor of NBC News, who wrote, House Transportation Chair Representative Peter DeFazio on Senate infrastructure bill. Quote, the crap written by those 12 rump senators who are all pro-fossil fuel actually does virtually nothing to reduce fossil fuel pollution from transportation. So I'm trying to fix that in reconciliation. He continued, they basically took out all of our climate provisions. They took my electric bus program and they cut it. And then they said, oh, and a third of the money has to be spent on fossil fuel buses. I mean, they're such jerks. The industry could have written their bill. That's why both bills need to go. The BIF, the hard infrastructure bill, the one that these conservadems want to want to pass without the other one, that's what Peter DeFazio is talking about there. That's what, that's why they're saying that bill alone will not cut it. We'll go along with that if you give us the other part. And they're not doing it for selfish reasons. Well, I guess they are. They're doing it selfishly for all of us. All of us. Got it? Ay, ay, ay. You know. And then, all right, so there's something going on with CNN, because someone else just tweeted, Waleed Shahid tweeted, atrocious and misleading Chiron at CNN, considering that the reconciliation package is also Biden's agenda. And what their Chiron says, here, let me see if I can't pull this up. I can. The Chiron says, progressive Dems dig in, threaten to tank Biden agenda. Again, the whole thing is the Biden agenda. The reconciliation bill is Joe Biden's agenda. They split it into two pieces so each side could have some leverage over the other side. If the progressives say, all right, we'll vote for this one now and we'll deal with the other one later, you know, later on in the fall when they get it finished written. The conservadems, who aren't centrist or moderate, will not vote for it. This was the reason that this two-pronged approach was set up. So each side had something, had some leverage over the other side. And now the media and the conservadems are trying to vilify the progressives. Well, sorry, that doesn't work. You can't do that. Well, they can. That's the problem. They can, so they figure they will. So I will be cheering on the progressives, from Pramila Jayapal to AOC, to as many of them who vote against the hard infrastructure bill. They're not trying to kill the bill. They're just trying to delay it until the other one is ready, and they can let the deal that they cut play out. And why so many in the so many Democrats, John Podesta, I'm looking at you, are willing to tank the deal that they negotiated? That's why Democrats lose. That's why we lose. I don't get what they don't get. I just don't understand it. Oh, man. All right, Dave Zirin is going to be joining us any minute now. I wonder if I have time to do this. Yeah, that's not the one I wanted to play for you. You know, I told you after a very long dearth in fun parody songs, there are a number of them. And that's not it either. All right. You know what? I'm going to play one. This one comes from Don Karen of the Parody Project with somebody else, with David Cohen. And, you'll see. All right. So take it away, Don Karen, if I can find the right. Oh, here it is. All right. So we'll do it this way. I hope this all works. We'll find out in a moment. Here. All right. Well, we'll try this. I got to get rid of the other stuff on the screen. Let me try it this way. And I'm keeping an eye out for Dave Zirin, who could be joining us at any moment now. That's the wrong one. Okay, this is the one. Is it? Sorry. I know this is really entertaining radio, isn't it? But it'll be worth it, I promise you, when I play for you. All right, I think this. All right, here we go. All right, take it away, Parody Project.
Someone told me it's not happening with this crew. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. Whoa, whoa, whoa. They're a waste of our tax dollars from the East Coast to the West. Just a pack of hate-filled losers who loathe blue. Yet they can stall and make a fuss as they try to stop change coal. Their constituents all love it when they do. And they do.
Yeah, 100% of our focus is on stopping this new administration.
Doesn't look like it is happening with this zoo. I do believe that. I do believe it's true. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Just a herd of power brokers from the Senate to the House. And the grunts are meant to rile and confuse. They howl there's no climate change and they rearrange our votes. While meddling with a woman's right to choose. Right to choose now. Whoa, whoa, whoa. McCarthy shows no honesty, McConnell's insincere, and Ted Cruz is most unkindly, and he's dumb.
I just love to twerk.
MTG's susceptible to changes in her rages, and did Mo Brooks wear a Kevlar vest for fun?
Will you fight for America?
Jordan is reactionary, Gates is sure no missionary, caucus plots in secrecy, and Gumner works quite frequently. What a gap we do not care to see with his crew. It's a zoo. Yeah, this crew is a zoo. With this crew.
The Parody Project, Don Karen. With this crew. There's our conundrum in song. All right. I'm still waiting for Dave Zirin. He should have been here by now. Oh, and there he is. Oh, I love it when things work out the way they're supposed to. All right. So while I get his shot set up, let me once again tell you that Dave Zirin's new book is out. It came out last week. I'm just getting our shot set up, Dave, so bear with me for 1 second here. So Dave Zirin of The Nation, of Edge of Sports podcast. You know what? I'm just gonna do this, and I think we're there. We're good. Hey, Dave Zirin, how are you?
Whoa, Nicole, how are you?
I'm hanging in there, riled up and angry as usual, but you know, here we are. I'm loving your book, though. So I'm so glad you could join us today. The book, as I mentioned earlier, is called The Kaepernick Effect: Taking a Knee, Changing the World. And you know, at first, when I was waiting for the book to arrive, I'm thinking, all right, so it's going to be a book about Colin Kaepernick and what he went through and how he got to this point where he took a knee and made a stand and cost himself a career, his career, but he stood on principle. But that's not what this book is about at all. It's really about the effect of Kaepernick's action on athletes and regular citizens, but really, in this case, athletes from high school kids on up. And I got goosebumps reading it. I'm so impressed with young people today. I wasn't so impressed with maybe my generation, but the young people, I feel really confident in turning everything over to them because they seem to know what's up. And it's evidenced by this. So what gave you the idea to do this, to do the effect of Kaepernick's actions?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I got to ask you just straight up. Am I echoing to you, Nicole?
No. Are you sounding echoey? Hold on.
Only a little bit on my end, but I can ride through it. No problem.
Okay. While you do that, I'm going to make sure. I always look to the chat room. So they'll let me know, and I'll play with the sound here. You shouldn't be echoing because you're only coming in on that one channel.
Yeah, it's okay. Just a little echo. I can stand it.
Okay.
Sorry. As long as it's the chat room say it's good, I'm happy to write on.
Okay, well, you are the only sports writer they ever read, by the way. Those are the comments I'm seeing. So there's that.
Hello. Well, let me tell you where I got the idea for this book, because I find it personally very interesting. I don't know if listeners will, but for me, this is very interesting. I was hanging out, just chewing the fat with 1968 Olympian John Carlos. Oh, the echo is totally gone.
Oh, good.
Okay. And John Carlos, of course, raised his fist on the medal stand in 1968 in Mexico City in the most iconic image of the era, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with John, and John said to me, you know, there were so many people at track meets after we came back from Mexico City who were just raising their fists all over the place. And the amateur historian in me was just like, what? who are these people? How did it affect their lives? And then I had to come to grips with the fact that, you know, wow, this was over 50 years ago. I'm not going to be able to really find folks and write about this. This is just getting lost to time. And frankly, lost the way so much of our history gets lost in this society, where we only focus on sort of like these exceptional leaders and leave out the mass of people who do the work. I mean, one cannot name a social struggle in the history of this country where that's not the case. And I think that's very intentional, because what it does is it makes a lot of people feel disempowered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, if I'm not this exceptional person, then I have no role to play in fighting for a better world. Because I didn't come down from Planet Awesome to do it. And that's not how history works. That's not really how movement works. But far too often, it's how we're taught them. And certainly, I saw that in what John Carlos was saying to me. It's like, wow, there was this mass of people who were supporting you, but we don't hear about them. There's no book about them. So that got me thinking about all these young people who I'd read about and had written about over the last 5 years who had taken a knee during the anthem to protest police brutality and racial inequity, taking that knee during the anthem because they really are protesting the gap between what this country promises and what it delivers to particularly Black and brown communities. So they were protesting the gap during the playing of the national anthem. And I'd seen all these one-off and written some of these one-off stories, and I started to think about it more holistically and thinking, wow, you know, if you think about it, you know, this is just what was ping-ponging inside my head. These stories took place all over the country, red mm-hmm. states, blue states, small towns, big cities. I'd love to do a book where I center their voices and let people understand this as a national reaction to what Colin Kaepernick did. Because Kaepernick's great contribution to struggle, I would argue, is that he gave a method by which one could express their discontent, not just as athletes, but as citizens. Like if you or I, Nicole, were at anything from a swap meet to an NFL game and the national anthem was played and we decided to take a knee, everyone would know what was going on.
Right.
You know,
right.
No one would think you lost a contact lens, for example. Right. Everyone would know what was going on. That's Colin Kaepernick's gift. And that's what a lot of these, particularly the young people, ran with. And most of them were in a state of dissatisfaction and anger before Colin Kaepernick ever took a knee. But when he took a knee, they saw a method by which they could turn anger into action. Now, so that's what the book, it was just going to be this nice, modest book where I center their voices and they tell their stories. But it really changed for me during the summer of 2020 after the killing of George Floyd, yeah. Because I started to think more about the demonstrations that were taking place. And this is during summer of 2020. I'd already interviewed a lot of the people for the book. And I was thinking like, wow, you know, I'd read in the New York Times that collectively the George Floyd demonstrations were the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States.
Wow.
In terms of numbers and the fact that they occurred in all 50 states.
And in the middle of COVID too, which adds a whole other different element on it. Yeah.
Yes. And it's just, I was thinking to myself, gosh, I wonder what all the folks that I spoke with are going through. So I started the process then of, you know, called my editor, said, hold off on the book. And started calling them and asking, how are you responding to this? Do you feel vindicated because of your own situation, which was much more isolated when you took a knee? And I also asked, what are you doing? You know, as these historic protests are taking place. And everybody with whom I spoke was an organizer. They were out there in the streets. They were doing things. They were feeling optimistic. They were feeling vindicated. Like it was such a vibe of, okay, you know, we were doing this. We were isolated. We were called all the terrible names you could think. Now the entire country is having this reckoning that we were trying to do years ago. And that to me then changed my idea about the book, because then I started to think, okay, many roads may have led us to the summer of 2020. But one of them runs straight through the playing fields of the United States, and that story needs to be told.
And you tell it beautifully, as you tend to do. So, Dave Zirin, you do, as evidenced by the comments I just read from the chat room. I'm not a sports person. I know I'm not a sports person, but I always enjoy reading you, and I always enjoy talking to you. And thankfully, you've graced my shows for, you know, the last 10 years or more, and I appreciate it, and I always enjoy our discussion. So this book is no different. But I got to say, this was a moment and an issue that resonated, because Colin Kaepernick is not the first athlete to make a stand. You mentioned John Carlos, you know, and that had some repercussions. But, you know, my husband has spent over 40 years as an agent for professional baseball players. And one of his clients was Carlos Delgado, who was a player for at the Toronto Blue Jays and then the Mets. But with the Mets, he just, you know, there was after 9/11, I guess they started standing for God Bless America or something. They started playing that at baseball games, which they never did before. And he chose not to come out for that, and took a lot of criticism for it. And just got criticized for it, but never caught on. He never got accolades or props for doing it. It was just his personal thing. So what was it? Is it just because so many people were feeling this, feeling what exactly Colin Kaepernick was protesting? Because
it was a perfect storm for Colin Kaepernick, an absolutely perfect storm. I mean, first and foremost, you had a movement in the streets in mass numbers. Second of all, that summer, Colin Kaepernick first did not stand for the anthem in August of 2016. And that summer was particularly volatile because of the police killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. And they were both killings were videotaped, and both killings went viral, which of course is very traumatizing for folks. So there were protests, there was anger, and Colin Kaepernick was feeling that anger too. And, you know, so that was one factor that created the perfect storm is this existence of a movement that was absolutely on fire at the time. You know, the second thing that made it huge is that this is the National Football League. You know, it's the closest thing to a national religion that we have in this country,
right,
or a national language even that we have in this country. Closest thing to a monoculture that we have in this country at this point. And, you know, we don't all watch the same shows anymore. We don't all listen to the same music. Yeah. I mean, it's
very,
things are sliced
very
and diced.
Fragmented. Yes.
Yes, and football is one of those last things that brings a lot of different eyeballs together. And of course, the most prominent position in football is quarterback. Mm-hmm. So here you have a quarter, and also the NFL is known for its hyper-patriotic excess, particularly after 9/11. So here you have Colin Kaepernick challenging all of that by refusing to stand for the anthem, and the amplification of what he was doing was just through the roof, because it was the National Football League. So, but there's another element in this perfect storm, and that's the very existence of Donald Trump, not to mention the entire presidential race that was going on in August of 2016.
Right.
Because for Colin Kaepernick, the fact that there was a presidential election going on was a 1,000% an irrelevancy to what he was doing, You know, it had much more to do with Alton Sterling and Philando Castile than it did Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But I think here, to be very frank, you see some of the differences between the two parties in this country, because it was immediately an issue everybody was talking about. And the Donald Trump campaign's response was, we're going for blood. This is exactly what we want. You know, we want black football player. He's got a big afro. We are going to hold him up as, you know, basically the symbol of everything that's wrong with America. And we're going to make sure we never talk about police brutality or any of the issues that Colin was trying to raise. We're going to make this about patriotism. We're going to make this about the troops. Donald Trump called for Colin Kaepernick to be fired from his job. Mm-hmm. He even made reference to Kaepernick leaving the country. You know, you don't like it here, you go somewhere else.
Right.
I mean, and come on, everybody knows what that means. That's go back to Africa when you
right.
say that.
Of course.
To a black person. So it's just openly racist. And then on the flip side, instead of having another political party say, that's outrageous, that racism cannot be tolerated, we support the right of anybody, whether they're a football player or whoever, to dissent. You know, kind of like the speech that Michael Douglas gives in An American President defending flag burning, you know? And it's like, that's Hollywood fantasy.
Yep.
Of what the Democratic Party is. Instead, you had a very tepid response. And I'm not at all putting all of this on Hillary Clinton. There was a tepid response from everybody in the leadership of the Democratic Party who was asked about this. It was basically their line was, well, you know, we support, but we don't. We wish he wouldn't, but he is. And that left Colin alone sort of on the island doing this. So that perfect storm sent it all just into the stratosphere in terms of as an issue. And it was, today is the 5-year anniversary of Colin Kaepernick being on the cover of Time magazine on one knee.
Wow.
And it was just, we just recently passed the 5-year anniversary of the first time he took a knee. So, you know, so in very, very quickly, to me, that just indicates how quickly this mushroomed into being a national story. And for some of the people I spoke with, like, I'm just thinking of one young man, Rodney Axon Jr., who was a football player, and he was the first person to take a knee after Colin Kaepernick. All he was waiting for was a way to show his discontent. He was already, it's Rodney's voice on the pages of my book. And Rodney talks about, and I interviewed dozens and dozens of people, and Rodney was one of them. And Rodney was just very straight up with me about the amount of racism he experienced on the football team, about how upset he was about what was happening in broader society, about how upset he was about how he was largely treated in a predominantly white suburb of Cleveland. And so he decides, as soon as Colin Kaepernick takes a knee, for Rodney, it's a eureka moment. Like he can't walk out of his house and go to the Black Lives Matter movement at the mall in Brunswick, Ohio. So what can he do? He can take a knee during the playing of the anthem of the football game. And as soon as he does it, an absolute uproar erupts. And much more of the book is about the aftermath of taking a knee than the right. act of taking the knee itself. And the backlash Rodney got was very intense. It was awful. He got death threats, racial threats, all sorts of things he had to deal with as a high school kid. I mean, it was so bad and so direct that, you know, he told me he was walking his elementary school age sister to school every day. For fear that harm might become her.
Oh,
and that to me was the first of a common thread that exists in the book, because you know, you have all these young people, and if you think about what they're actually doing, they're engaging in an act of peaceful civil disobedience.
Right.
Is what they're doing. And the response is not, wow, you're raising some good points. Let's have a discussion. Or, gee, I still don't agree with you, but let's disagree without being disagreeable. No, the response is violence.
Right.
Threat of violence. And that to me is, you know, I wrote this book before all this recent stuff with either the masks or the, you know, critical race theory stuff. And you see this on the side of the right that it's like they think violence is an appropriate and proper political reaction to somebody saying to them, gee, maybe this world isn't the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. You know, we're speaking with Dave Zirin. The new book is The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. And, you know, I was mostly moved by the high school kids because, these kids are so tough. They're so strong and they're so aware of what's going on around them. And so you tell the story, you deal with a number of them, but I want to focus in on Garfield High School in Seattle. And some of the kids you talk about and the coach there. And one of the kids went to the coach and said, you know, I want to do this. And the coach said, well, we need to have a talk about this first. And they really talked it out and talked about the issues. Why don't you tell us? Because you obviously, I read it, you wrote it. So tell us what they went through and how the process went for them to decide to do this.
Well, first and foremost, so folks know, Garfield High School in Seattle is a pretty remarkable place. It's the school of Quincy Jones. It's the school of Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
It's a school that in a overwhelmingly white city, Garfield High School is like a fulcrum of Black arts and Black culture. And it makes sense, therefore, that this would be the school where first players on the football team would say, we want to be part of this movement against racism. And this predominantly white football team said, we're going to take a knee because if there's a problem that affects one of our teammates, it affects all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so the coach, Joey Thomas, said, well, we're only going to do this if we do it as a team. So let's have a team discussion about this. And sure enough, through the process of debate and discussion, as well as an analysis of the national anthem and its history and the verses we do not sing.
The third verse, which they talked about at length, right?
The infamous third verse. And with all of that, they all decided to take a knee. Now, you would think that in a city like Seattle, so liberal, that they would be feted for this. But the reality was Coach Thomas, he had his tires slashed of his car. Actionable death threats were called into the school. Students received individual threats. But then on the flip side, it also spread to the soccer team, to the softball team, young women athletes, young men athletes. They were all doing it now in solidarity with this besieged football team. And it really ends with Coach Thomas being forced out of his job. He now coaches in Florida. And believe me, I tracked down that story and spoke to people at the superintendent's office in Seattle. And it was like, ugh.
Right.
It was like trying to talk to Nixon about the Kennedy assassination. Wow. I mean, it was like under lock and key. They would not speak about why Joey Thomas lost his job. And they just refused to comment no matter how much I pushed. And Joey Thomas was like, yeah, I lost my job because I was part of these young people who took a knee and I didn't smack them down. Instead, I tried to raise them up. And the story of Coach Joey Thomas, the story of a coach named Bob Berg, who I speak to, and he's a coach at Denby High School in Detroit, Coach Preston Brown in Camden, New Jersey. It was very, very intentional and purposeful for me to talk to coaches as well. Because I want people to see that not all coaches, because so many of these stories have coaches who just, you know, either stab their kids in the back or the front when they take that knee. and act terribly. And so I wanted to give like these positive case examples of what it is for a coach to actually be an educator and not somebody who's just in it for themselves. You know, this former Baltimore Colt who does coaching seminars named Joe Ehrman, who's brilliant. Joe once said to me, there are two kinds of coaches, the transformational and the transactional. The transactional is really just in it for themselves and how it makes them feel. The transformational, are they're in it for the team and they want to see the team develop as young men and young women as part of the process of being a coach.
It's very moving. And yes, he's down here in Florida now. I guess he's at FAU, right? Which is 20 minutes away from me. So, but the fact that he had to leave Seattle of all places because the reaction was so tough. And these kids dealt with it too. I mean, they dealt with, at first some people were supportive and then they like turned on them as the nation heated up. And you tell so many different stories. Dave Zirin, there's one paragraph or one section that I flagged that I want to share. And it has to do with the players of Minneapolis North and, sure, and somebody named Marjan Sirdar.
Mm-hmm.
And Marjan Sirdar said this: these same people who ridiculed these kids for taking a knee are the people that said, oh, you could have protested peacefully. The same motherfuckers who denied equity, the same motherfuckers who forced the governor's hand to reopen the state and send my people back to work to die for $10 an hour so they can clip these motherfuckers' nails. These are my youths that are in the street on the front lines. These are my youths that are in the essential jobs. These are my former students. They took a knee because their parents have been on the front lines of the wage war their whole lives, and they saw it. Their community has been invaded by these terrorist organizations their whole life. Those kids tried to protest peacefully 4 years ago. Cap, he tried to take a knee. Now what did they say? Why don't you do it peacefully? Why, you gotta be looting? Well, we did it peacefully, motherfuckers. You threw the man out of the NFL and called him and the players that supported him sons of bitches. These young people who took a knee, I'm sure a lot of them are out there protesting too, 100%, and maybe a few of them burning some shit down. The powers that be literally stole land. They extracted labor. They stole people's liberty. They ended people's lives and then they denied them justice. Then the politicians are like, why are you burning shit down? They're blaming us. Order, they're saying. Order over justice. They did. Colin Kaepernick, this was the definition of a peaceful protest. These kids peacefully protested. People tried to peacefully protest. In fact, I would say they did. And the violence and the looting, for the most part, was not started by them, but by others who were instigating it. They tried to protest peacefully, and this was their reward.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes I feel like, and this is an obvious point, that we live just in parallel realities in this country. You know, I live in a reality where 2020, the summer thereof, was a remarkable moment, a historical moment, a turning point, the largest protest in the history of the United States, all 50 states. And yet there are people in this country who view it as, oh, this was just people burning and looting down their communities. And, you know, they're lying and we're not. Let me just put that out there straight up. They're lying and we're not. So then you have to ask yourself, why are they lying? And the answer is quite frankly is fear.
Yeah,
I mean, because this is what happens in this country. You have the largest demonstrations in history. Look what's come out of it. You know, not laws against, you know, racism or try to address police violence. No, but stuff about the critical race theory hysteria, which is just the biggest load of hooey in the world. And so clearly and transparently, just a load of crap. I mean, it's a legal theory, and they're saying it's being taught in elementary schools.
It is not.
And there are teachers who don't know what they're talking about. Like, and what they're really talking about when you drill down to it is they don't want white children to learn about slavery.
That's right. And in Texas, they're even rewriting the books, the history books, to say, to equate slavery with a form of immigration, to take Martin Luther King out of the history books. It's stunning. So,
And that's what we're dealing with. So that's the all of this stuff, though. And we don't we never talk about this enough, certainly not in the mainstream media, that all of this critical race theory stuff, all of the voter attack on voting rights, it's a reaction to 2020.
That's right. That's right.
It's a reaction. It is a backlash reaction to the fact that, whoa, the other side is getting organized. And whoa, there are a lot of white kids on those demonstrations. Whoa. Oh, yeah. You know, all of that threatens them. What they're threatened by more than anything else is this young generation with whom I speak with, who made me so optimistic in the process of putting this book together. And this generation is less tolerant of intolerance than any generation in the history of the United States. And the fear of them is hysterical.
Right. And good. I say more power to them. I'm excited for this next generation to take over. And I say, bring them on. Dave Zirin, the book is The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. It's awesome. And again, as I mentioned, you know, earlier in the week, last or a couple of weeks ago, 9/11, I talked about my friend Jim Defeati's book called The Day the World Came to Town, which will... It'll help your idea of humanity. It'll give you a good feeling and believe that there's hope for humanity, because we've seen so much ugliness, especially recently. It shows you that there are people who are doing the right things for the right reasons. It's a great book. I love it. Thank you for writing it. And Dave Zirin, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you again for joining us today.
Great to talk to you too, McPhee.
You take care. Thanks again. And until next time.
Yes.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. Dave Zirin, he's really good. If you can't tell, I'm a fan. And again, I'm not a sports person. My husband is, but I'm, you know, baseball been good to him. But, you know, me? Yeah. And that's it. We're done for the day. That hour flew. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein is usually here on Thursdays, but he's got a doctor's appointment tomorrow. So in his stead, we're going to be joined by Brittany Ramos de Barros. She is running for Congress from New York's 11th District. That's that Staten Island, Brooklyn district that Max Boot won, remember, in 2018, and a Republican beat him in 2020. He was horrible anyway. She's great. So we'll meet a real progressive who can finally, hopefully, win that district and get them where they should be. I'm looking at the comments in the chat room. This book was really good, and again, it'll make you feel good. It'll give you confidence that the young people, they've got this. I feel good about them taking over. And again, Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn need to retire and let this next generation come in. Max Rose. Who? What did I say? Max Boot? Oh, he's the New York Times guy. Max Rose. Right. Okay. Thank you. There's my correction for the day. Did I do okay with Dave Zirin? Yeah. Okay. He says okay. All right. That's it. I'll leave you with the news, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great night. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It appears we have a standoff at the Capitol. House Democrats passed a bill Tuesday night that would suspend the debt ceiling, avoiding a potentially catastrophic debt default. But Senate Republicans have insisted they will not vote for the suspension, setting up a standoff over an issue that both sides agree on. Failing to deal with the debt limit could upend financial markets and even disrupt basic government operations. Mitch McConnell's signature obstruction could not only tank the good faith and credit of the United States, but it's just one part of a larger and potentially even more catastrophic outcome that the entire two-pronged Biden Build Back Better infrastructure plan could be completely derailed, too. So now President Biden is taking a larger role. Both Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer go to the White House on Wednesday to meet with the president, and so will a cross-section of House and Senate Democrats. Some of those making the trek include progressives Pramila Jayapal, Mark Pocan, Barbara Lee, and Jim McGovern, and conservadems Josh Gottheimer, Stephanie Murphy, Stephen Horsford, Suzanne DelBene, and Mike Thompson. Pramila Jayapal is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Gottheimer leads the Problem Solvers Caucus. and is probably the most vocal conservadem in the House. Gottheimer's the one who got Pelosi to agree to put the bipartisan infrastructure bill on the floor by September 27th. That's next Monday. As part of that agreement, Pelosi said she'd work to get the votes for that $1 trillion so-called bipartisan infrastructure package, or BIF. The Senate passed that legislation in early August by a pretty big bipartisan margin, giving Biden a chance for a political win on one of his key issues. But Jayapal says that at least 48 of her fellow progressives are ready to block passage of that because of the other part of the bill, the reconciliation package. The larger part of Biden's American Jobs Plan and Americans Family Plan is nowhere close to being done. And a deal was cut, saying one would not pass without the other. Greg Sargent in the Washington Post confirms that the progressives are insisting on sticking to the original deal that was cut. I guess now we wait and see how persuasive Joe Biden can be. Speaking of the president, he addressed the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday for the first time since becoming president. He said that the United States was, quote, opening a new era of relentless diplomacy, that he's determined to work closely with other world powers to address global threats following the American military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Biden also said his administration would dedicate its resources to ending the pandemic, fighting terrorism, and adjusting to shifting global power dynamics to better collaborate with other nations on matters of common concern, such as trade and cyber threats. And the president vowed to double U.S. spending on international climate aid to $11.4 billion a year by 2024. But critics tell us the raised figure still falls far short of what U.S. allies are contributing, and it represents roughly one-eighth of what the world's largest historical emitter would need to pay to account for its cumulative share of carbon heating the planet. Moving on. Although the former guy and his minions have claimed that the 2020 presidential election was riddled with fraud, a newly discovered memo shows that many of their lawyers' election fraud claims against Dominion voting systems and election software company Smartmatic were not true. Shocker. It appears the Trump campaign allowed its so-called lawyers, including Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, to continue spreading fake news and filing lawsuits despite zero evidence to support conspiracy theories about voting machines. Court papers were filed late last week and released Monday night as part of a defamation lawsuit against Trump campaign officials being spearheaded by former Dominion employee Eric Coomer. Those documents also indicate the officials were aware of the baseless allegations ahead of the widely watched November 19th news conference, during which Trump campaign's legal team claimed Dominion, Smartmatic, George Soros, and Venezuela worked together to steal the election from Trump. Oy. Meanwhile, the former guy filed a $100 million lawsuit Tuesday against his niece, Mary Trump, and the New York Times, claiming they conspired to obtain his tax records for the Times Pulitzer Prize-winning story on his finances. The lawsuit claims that Mary Trump and the three New York Times reporters, Suzanne Craig, David Barstow, and Russell Buettner, were engaged in a, quote, insidious plot and an extensive crusade to obtain Trump's taxes. The Times responded with a statement, quote, "The Times' coverage of Donald Trump's taxes helped inform the public through meticulous reporting on a subject of overriding public interest. This lawsuit is an attempt to silence independent news organizations, and we plan to vigorously defend against it." Mary Trump's response was quicker and to the point, quote, "I think he is a effing loser." But she used the full word, and we tend to agree. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button. And you guys got me over 20,000! 20,002 Twitter followers. All right, I'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everyone.